السلام عليكم.
عليكم السلام ورحمة الله. Hold on a second, let me put my headphones on.
Welcome to the first episode of season two of Kalam Cast podcast. You're the first guest of the second season.
Are we starting right away?
Starting right away.
Okay.
Usually the way I like to do it is just not even tell people. And so the conversation is more genuine because I've noticed when you tell people that you're recording, they become like soldiers, basically, like they're afraid to make the wrong statement, which is understandable, but it's not really what you want on a podcast. You want people to be genuine and authentic and all that sort of stuff. So, Brother Aftif, I've known you for quite a while, and ever since I've known you, you've always been at one particular university. We don't necessarily need to mention the name of the university. Maybe you want to keep your privacy. That's up to you. But the point is, you've been at that same place, I think, for the last 20, 25 years, something like that.
21 years as an employee and 26 years or 27 years as a student before that.
That's quite good.
If you include the student years. Yes, sorry.
How does one get at that level where, number one, they become an academic of your caliber and then they proceed in this very long and lengthy career? What generally needs to happen in order to get to that place in the first place?
Wow, okay.
I know it's a big question, but just very briefly.
When I was a student at the University of Melbourne, so there you go, I've just named the university. I finished my undergraduate and I went straight into an academic position, which is not something you can do nowadays, right? In those days, this is the late 90s, they were taking on bachelor's students who had completed at least 4 to 5 years of study straight into an academic career. And I was very fortunate that when I graduated, the very same, not exactly the very same year, but like there was a new department that had been formed called the Department of Information Systems in the Faculty of Science. And I was doing some research with an academic who had shifted on to that department. He said to me, why don't you, join as a early career academic. And I did. And I hadn't started my PhD at the point. I started my PhD simultaneously while I became an academic. And that was around 1998. And so fast forward to 2021, I just stayed within the University of Melbourne and spent many years as a full-time teaching and research academic.
So you've got a very interesting field that you're an academic of, that you're teaching and lecturing on. And I don't want to get it wrong. So would it be possible for you to explain exactly what is your specialization?
Okay, so I'm an associate professor at the School of Computing and Information Systems, and I'm the deputy director of the Center of Excellence of Cybersecurity. So my area is cybersecurity, but it's not what people normally think. So cybersecurity is by and large a very technical field. And it's dominated by technologists, and that's another way of saying largely electrical engineers, computer scientists, and so forth. But I'm on the business management side, so I don't necessarily study or research the development of new technologies or new algorithms. I instead study how organizations behave when they're under cyber attack. So that's a completely different field. It's around the management practice of cybersecurity in organizations. And that's my area of specialty.
So basically you're not a hacker.
I am not a hacker. Yes, I am definitely not a hacker. When I was an undergraduate student, I became very interested in my whole journey to cybersecurity, because I started off as a software engineer, computer scientist. And around the third year of my undergraduate degree, I became fascinated by computer viruses. Right. And it's particularly because computer viruses were able to move from one computer to another computer without human intervention. Mm-hmm. And that really fascinated me. How is that possible? I mean, how can you create a piece of code that propagates across networks? It does it at speed, and it can do it en masse. So you could, in a sense, propagate a program could propagate across the entire internet within a very short period of time. And that was just incredibly fascinating for me. And that's how I started in cybersecurity. I started thinking about viruses. I started thinking about hackers. I read a lot of books about hacker lore. In those days, Masters of Deception, Cuckoo's Egg. These were some very well-known books fascinating books, and I consumed them. I did my first internship at an antivirus company called VET, V-E-T, which was eventually taken over by Computer Associates. And my role in that organization was to catalog all the different variants of viruses, so on index cards. So I used to just sit there and with an index card write down the name of the virus, the variant, and its unique messaging and its template, and what differentiated one virus from another virus. And that's all I did. And that's how I actually got into this area from a very technical perspective. And I thought that I was really going to stay technical. And then I did some very interesting training, which was with some military people, which brought me to the world of tactics and strategy and battlefields. And these military people helped to open my entire, sort of worldview around, cybersecurity. Well, they weren't in cybersecurity. They were on the military side of things, but I began to see in cybersecurity, the whole military side of cybersecurity, organizations under attack, battlefields in the digital environment, nation states fighting each other. And then I decided when I, back at university to create a new research team, one that is a mix of intelligence, military intelligence, cyber defense, business management. So we created a new team in research. There's no team like this in the country, in Australia, maybe very few, if any, in the world. So we are a very unique research team, and now we've become globally recognized as one of the leading research teams in cybersecurity from an incident response perspective.
So basically, you guys are the Avengers of cybersecurity.
We're researchers, so we observe how organizations behave, and we do intervene. Like we're kind of like ethnographers or anthropologists. An anthropologist will go to a village and they'll sort of act like they're the they'll be the objective observer, and they'll watch people and they'll very carefully ask questions about why do people behave like that, or we do the same thing, but we do it inside like banks and telecommunications, and we watch their behavior, we interview people, we ask them questions, and then we try to put the story together. Like, why does the organization have these vulnerabilities? Why do they have these deficiencies? Why aren't they able to protect themselves? Why did they get hit so badly? And how could they restructure the organization or use different tools or use different processes to be able to better defend themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so we like to work with the organizations, that have the highest stakes. And that's usually banks or telecommunications firms or pharmaceutical firms, where there's a lot to lose and where they have invested a huge amount of money in cybersecurity. That's where you'll find us.
That's a very sort of interesting area. You admittedly, I can see why that pull is there for people who have studied what you have studied.
Well, one of the most common things that we see in organizations is a bank taking on a country. So for example, a nation state based attack on a bank. Now, banks are very interesting because in particular banks, there's a lot to gain by hitting a bank, right? There is the obvious, obvious thing that if you hit a bank and you can infiltrate them, penetrate their defenses, you can commit fraud. You can get access to information about people's bank accounts and you can steal money. And that's sort of just the beginning of it. Nation states have this extra incentive that they can get intelligence on mergers and acquisitions. They can get market intelligence. They can disrupt national commerce. They can reduce trust in financial systems. Just recently there was this massive attack on one of the big banks here, which, if you think about it, the national commercial financial system in countries like Australia and New Zealand, these areas, it's completely run by private banks. The federal government regulates, but doesn't control the infrastructure itself. And so imagine if a bank were to go down, the entire national commerce infrastructure would go down. So the stakes are very high. So when that bank gets attacked, and the attacks are not straightforward attacks. There was an attack recently, which was started as a DDoS attack, which is like a denial of service attack. Well, somebody just put in, huge amounts of garbage on the internet and aimed it at the bank, and it would just tied up the bank's entire resources. And that was just stage one. when the bank's resources are all consumed, then they hit them with stage two, which was to actually very target, you know, a particular aspect of it, which is related to the mission objectives of the people doing the attack, right? So the banks are have become quite, you can say, knowledgeable and experienced in surviving attacks like these, right? And that's where things get really interesting, because when you look at the teams and you see, I mean, a bank will normally have 20 to 25 full-time employees looking at cybersecurity only, right? Plus maybe 4 to 6 people in threat intelligence. So they've got a massive, you know, massive infrastructure, a lot of teams, a lot of money invested in it. And the teams are working together like you know, armies, very structured, very regimented, clear idea of what's going on and having to move very quickly because these attacks obviously in the digital environment propagate very quickly. So it's fascinating just watching these organizations work.
Yes, just based on your explanation, it seems very interesting. It seems very, it seems like one of those topics that it opens up an array of different other topics as well. Like you have to examine the psychology of people as well, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, can you give us an example of the type of studies that are within this branch of or field that you are actually a part of?
Yeah, so the last study that we did, the most recent one, looked at situation awareness in organizations, and they asked the basic question. I mean, if a bank gets hit by, well, it doesn't have to be a bank, but any large multinational company with a very, you know, so you can imagine, take any multinational bank. They have this sprawling heterogeneous IT infrastructure across maybe 30 countries. They may have something like, you know, 5 to 10,000 employees. They may have maybe 9 to 10 million customers. You know, we're talking about the you know, big banks here in this region.
Right.
And you know, given that kind of IT infrastructure, the number of you know, how do they get situation awareness of their digital environment? That's the question we asked, right? How does an organization like that get a sense of its situation across 30 countries with that kind of IT infrastructure? Mm. And what we saw was the way that banks and telecoms firms mostly do this, almost everybody, is they task all the IT equipment to create log entries. You know, so every IT device has this function which allows it to create a system activity log. And they suck all the system activity logs across all their IT infrastructure into this massive, you know, machine, right? This other IT platform. This primary job is to suck all this information and correlate it, aggregate it, and then run some algorithms on it to detect to see what is going on, right? Signature algorithms. You might be surprised to know that every 24 hours, this particular organization had roughly 20 billion log entries related to security, right? So they have to go through 20 billion log entries every 24 hours, which relate to security. They've got to, you know, digest it, understand it, and then run alerts from it. And those alerts start the process of they go to like their level one SOC, which is the security operations center. People will look at these dashboards and they'll try to understand what the alert is about. They'll do some investigation, they'll create some context. And you know, it just goes from what is the context, what's going on, can we make sense of it? Then can we project into the future what the next step is for this attacker? What should we do? How do we head them off? How do we protect themselves? This is the study we did. And we came up with a model to explain to all organizations, right? How do you develop situation awareness to the extent that you can respond with speed, flexibility, and with agility, right? And that was the aim. And we published it in the leading journal, Computers and Security. And the reviewers that read the paper were like totally, their minds were blown. There was one reviewer who said, in all of my 10 years, I have never read such a good paper that clearly explained to me what is going on. Because again, you know, one of the things as ethnographers we can do is we can put the pieces together. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of researchers will only look at a very small piece, like one type of computer system or one type of algorithm. And whereas we'll come in and we'll explain how the whole organization works, from the IT people to the managers to the senior executives to the chief information security officer, we'll explain how the whole machine works. And that is like a light bulb moment for a lot of researchers in this area that have been there for 20 years, right? It's like, oh my God, so that's how they do it, right? And it's really hard to do this because one of the reasons why there are very few other academics in the area is because you can't get access to these organizations. they won't let you come in and see. It's extremely confidential, right? But for us, again, being at the University of Melbourne for 20 years and teaching students for 20 years, some of the students that we taught in 2003, 2004 are now extremely, they're like, in this particular organization, the person who invited me was the chief strategist for the whole organization, chief cybersecurity strategist. And given he was a former student, he invited us to come in and have a look and arranged all the interviews and arranged everything for us. Right. And that's, again, you know, part of the fact that if you're an academic in the space for so long and you're, you know, at the forefront of your knowledge, you get these opportunities, you get these invitations to go into these big banks or big telecoms, and then to study them and to publish about them.
I can see a great deal of passion in what it is that you're actually talking about. Where does this passion come from? Because a lot of people, they may potentially become tired being in the same field for 20 plus years. So how do you have this much passion for your particular field?
I don't know. That's a hard question. I've been thinking about this field for so long. I think maybe it's the goal. I've always wanted to come up with a theory of warfare in the digital environment, right? So if you know Sun Tzu, very famous Chinese, you know, historian / general, has written The Art of War. Mm-hmm. And that book has really directed military strategists for many, many years. And then, you know, Clausewitz wrote the book, The Art of War. But much, much before that, Khalid ibn Walid defined the rules of warfare in a flat environment, right? He did something that people thought was impossible to do, which was what is strategy in a desert, right? Now everybody knows guerrilla warfare and strategy in the tropical jungle where there's, you know, hills and mountains and trees and different terrains. You can hide behind things. You can take camouflage. You can do all these things. But in the desert where there's nothing to hide behind, there are no trees. There is no such thing as camouflage, at least not in the traditional sense. Mm. Khalid bin Walid came up with these new rules of warfare around maneuverability, speed and agility on a flat plane, which allows you to do similar things. And those you know, rules of warfare, which are not for some reason well known outside of military circles. I mean, General Rommel, you know, who was one of Hitler's generals, made some comments when he was in North Africa around how much he learned from the warfare tactics that Khalid bin Walid invented. Because there are very few people who had to think about warfare and strategy in the desert environment from Europe, except for, you know, particularly Italians who went into the North Africa or the Germans, etc. And everybody's familiar because in desert warfare, we don't know much. So I've been fascinated by the question, what are the rules of warfare in the digital environment? And what's really interesting about the digital environment is that other than the fact that it's obviously nothing like the physical environment, the whole idea of speed in the physical world and speed in the digital world are different, right? And also access. I mean, in the physical world, one country cannot really engage another country in warfare unless they're either connected, they share a border, or one or both of them have access to water, right? So you can have aircraft carriers and so forth. But in the digital world, any IP, any internet address from anywhere in the world can attack another internet address, right? There's no concept of distance. There's no concept of time, you know, in terms of speed and also economics. You know, if you make a weapon in the physical world and you want to make another one, you have to build a new one, you know? But in the digital world, you make one virus, you can make a million copies of a virus at no cost, right? So all of these things, they may sound to be disconnected, but in the digital environment, when organizations or nation states go to war, then they all come into play, right? Even one individual can take on a whole nation state, right? Because it's very cheap to attack. It takes more knowledge than it takes money. It takes that curiosity to know about technology and its vulnerabilities, and it gives you a disproportionate amount of power, right? So in the olden days, in the 90s and so forth, we would read about teams of hackers who could take on entire countries. We saw the film War Games, Yeah, it was mind-blowing when I first saw that film. You know, just one hacker without even understanding the power that he had turned, you know, managed to infiltrate a US Army and you know, create this simulation. Well, play what he thought was a game, but turned out to be an actual war game simulation and set off countries on the, you know, towards collision course. And that's a really good sort of, in a sense, metaphor for, you know, what's happening in the digital environment. People with disproportionate amount of power able to do things that they shouldn't be able to do with very little investment, very little knowledge, but considerable leverage, right? And that's what really fascinates me. So how does warfare happen in the digital environment? I would love to be the one to write that theory, right? To explain to the world how this happens.
It is quite fascinating, and it does actually make a lot of sense compared to what I actually do know about you, your interest in, you know, historic battles and so forth. It connects well with that other interest that you have. So it makes a great deal of sense to me now. So in terms of those people or those processes that contain a great deal of power, are you able to sort of elaborate on that? You know, how does that actually work?
So, sorry, could you elaborate on your question?
You talked about these, you know, people who have a great deal of power and, you know, they're exerting their influence through, you know, digital means. How does that actually work? What did you actually mean by that?
So I'll give you an example. Ransomware is a really good example, right? So, you know, ransomware is really taking the world by storm. And maybe 15 years ago, people never really thought much about ransomware. What is ransomware? Ransomware is basically, you know, somebody, not usually one person, but an organized crime syndicate infiltrating your organization and digitally locking your IT infrastructure and your information, and asking you, you know, holding your own IT infrastructure and your own information to ransom, basically saying, we've locked this up, you can't access it. If you want access back, if you want to get access to your own IT infrastructure and for us to release this lock, and you have to pay us a certain number of dollars, and we'll then unlock all of this, give you back the keys to your castle, so to speak, and disappear into the sunset with your money, right? And in the past, you know, this was not unheard of, but now a few things have come into play for this to happen, you know, to make this happen, you know, and there are key, you know, few moving parts here. Number one, these groups exist in a part of the world that doesn't care what they do, right? As long as they don't attack that part of the world, right? So we're talking about former Warsaw Pact countries, Eastern Europe, where these organizations are basically like any other organization. People come to work at 9 a.m., they knock off at 5 p.m., they wear suits and ties, they've got health insurance. It's basically a job. And the organization basically profiles who's got deep pockets in the West, first world countries usually, and they basically have their tools. They basically go into the organization, they lock it up, and they go, okay, if you want this to be unlocked, ring up this number, here's the helpline. And they're very polite. It's very much like customer service, right? Very polite about it, saying, this is what we're asking for. You know, we think that it's a fair, you know, amount of money. And they, by the way, usually know what the bank account, you know, what the balance of the organization is. They've already infiltrated the banks. They already know what your bank balance is. So you can say, I can't afford that, because they'll quote back to you how much money you have, what your assets are worth. And they've got a formula that they'll use to determine how much it'll cost you to rebuild your entire infrastructure, as opposed to how much it'll, you know, how much they should charge for that ransom. And most organizations will find very quickly that it pays pay off the ransom, you know, where asked, rather than try to rebuild everything.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You see that the pricing is very, very strategic. If it costs you $100,000 to rebuild your IT infrastructure, they'll ask you for maybe $5,000 or $10,000.
Oh, wow.
And which is a lot for them, because they're not hitting just you. They're hitting maybe 1,000 organizations like you in one area, right? So they're making a lot of money, but they're very careful about making sure, you know, that you pay, because they're in the business of getting paid, not in the business of not getting paid. So they'll lower their prices to whatever they think you can afford.
That is quite scary in a way, actually.
Yeah. And I should also point out that they can run away with this money because of the emergence of cryptocurrency, you know, right. Bitcoin and so forth. Right? Whereas in the past, you couldn't do that. Right? In the past, mm-hmm. if you pay, you know, then those dollar, you know, serial numbers could be written and you could hide inside the you know, the bag, these, you know, sprays, these permanent ink sprays that would color it and make the money unusable. But now with Bitcoin and so forth, it's untraceable. So they can take the money and you can't find them anymore.
So does that mean there's new processes in place to help weed out these bad actors?
Well, you see, that's why I said that they're in jurisdictions that are untouchable, right? They deliberately operate from jurisdictions that are untouchable because they know that if the organization decides to retaliate, then they need to be in a place where they can't be reached physically. Right. And they're getting more brazen. I mean, the Colonial Pipeline, you know, attack that was recent, you know, that really shook the U.S. and it really pushed the senior, you know, the government executive administration to then deal with this at a national level. Right. And you see, that's where the money is, but that's where the stakes are a lot higher and the possibility of blowback is much more real. Right. Mm-hmm. So they have been until recently been playing this very safe game where they'll hit small potatoes and they'll just do it by hitting a lot of organizations, you know, at scale. But as they become more brazen, and now you should really, it helps to understand that they are in the spectrum of ransomware attackers or organized crime syndicates. They're very rational, business like people. And then there's also the cowboys who go, oh, I'm going to take down, you know, Amazon or Microsoft or blah, blah. And, you know, I'm smart enough. I'll do it. And they may actually make it difficult for everybody else in the ransomware industry as well, because if they end up hitting the wrong organization and getting the government involved, then it's not just the government coming after them. It's actually the government cleaning house of all ransomware. So even within that industry, there's a lot of politics and a lot of power plays going on. Right. You know?
So you touched on something very important at the very beginning when we were introducing you, and you spoke about your particular interest in how you got into this field, and that sort of allows us to touch upon something else. And that is, if someone wants to get into this field, you know, a lot of us have young children, and we notice that they have interests in computers and programming, or, you know, coding as they call it today. What would you recommend for parents of these children?
Maybe I should start by saying, by talking about what is cybersecurity, right? Okay. And then come to this, right? So the reason why I want to start with this question of what is cybersecurity is because there's a lot of misunderstanding of this area. Cybersecurity, in order to understand cybersecurity, we have to understand the impact that digitization has had on humanity, right? Digitization has really changed the way that we live in our, you know, in our daily lives. And the biggest change is that digitization has changed even the most core critical infrastructures that we use on a routine basis. So whether it's power, you know, the electricity network, whether it's the water network, whether it's banking, whether it's government, whether it's media, whether it's transport, emergency services, airports, even in our homes, right? All the core services that we use now, our essential services, are driven by information technology. But I actually don't think about information technology as much as I think about information systems. And the reason why I think about information systems is because it's not just the hardware and the software, it's the information, the content within it, and the people and how they interact with it collectively. It's that ecosystem that brings value. The question isn't about hardware, it's about value. You know, where is the value in our lives that's driven by these services? And you'll see if you trace the value chain, the hardware on its own that provides the value. I mean, if I gave you an empty mobile phone with no software on it, no apps on it, what could you do with it? Nothing, right? But if I added, okay, you know, hardware, and I added apps to the hardware, and you know, you had hardware and software, you would see more value, right? Because you can interact with the apps. But if the apps were very poorly designed and nobody could really use the apps, it's useless again. So the apps have to be designed so that people can use them. And the apps have to be interconnected, right? Through what we call the worldwide network, or the, you know, the internetworking environment, for people to use them to their best advantage, right? So I mean, there's no point in me having a phone, which is really just a walkie-talkie, a two-way, you know, point-to-point radio communication. My phone can do some amazing things. My phone and your phone and our phones are so powerful that if you just go back 10 years, they're more powerful than possibly maybe even most devices in the world 10 years ago, each phone, right? So at the bottom line here is digitization has created this information systems-based environment. So the question is, what is cybersecurity? Cybersecurity, you know, is not just a technical problem. It's actually a problem that sits on two major issues. Number one, making sure that these services are available to us when we need them. That's really important. So it's the availability of IT services, digital platforms. So I don't even think about hardware and software anymore. I just think about digital platforms. And so these digital platforms that allow us to do things, we need to make sure that they're always available to us and they're able to provide the value that we need them to provide to us for them to be usable and functional, right? That availability is a key issue that cybersecurity grapples with. The second issue is confidentiality, right? It's the information inside those platforms that can leak, can be stolen, can be compromised, and can create all kinds of problems for us. And the confidentiality has two sides to it. It's the privacy side of our digital identity, right? Because, you know, when we use the internet, when we use our phone, it's not us physically using it, it's our digital identity that's on it that enables us to do the things that we do. So protecting the digital identity is part of that confidentiality problem. Mm. But it's also a broader problem at a societal level about information and its sensitivity, whether it's patient data, whether it's about assets that telecommunications have, whether it's blueprints of engineering, you know, IT infrastructures or fiber optic cables or power networks or all those sorts of things, the massive amount of valuable information out there that if it gets into the wrong hands can become a real problem, right? So cybersecurity sits on two pillars, confidentiality of information and availability of digital platforms. That's fundamentally what it's about. So now back to your question. So the question now is, if we go back and we revisit the earlier question, how do I get my child into cybersecurity? Well, let's start by this. 5 or 10 years ago, cybersecurity was very much assumed to be a technical problem, right? A problem that was centered in technology and only technical people can understand it and only technical people can handle it. And I mean, I grapple with this problem every day of my working career, right? You know, senior executives in most of the firms that I study, they are very, very afraid They're very reluctant to get involved in any conversation around cybersecurity because they believe it to be best handled by their technical people. Mm. And so they delegate it to the technical people. And what's happening in the last maybe 5 years or so is becoming patently obvious that cybersecurity is not just a technical problem. It's actually a much wider, for a private enterprise, it's a business problem, right? And you can imagine if your organization, if you're a bank and you get hit and hundreds of thousands of people's, you know, bank balances suddenly go to zero, right? That's a business problem. It might have been, you know, might have been perpetrated through a technical cybersecurity attack, but it's ultimately a business problem, right? If ransomware hits your organization and locks you up and you can't do business, that's a business problem, right? Mm-hmm. And you can't afford to delegate that to technical people, right? Mm-hmm. You cannot afford, especially if the technical people are under-resourced and extremely, extremely busy trying to keep the IT infrastructure just running, right? They don't have time to deal with business problems. They're barely just running the system. So bottom line, there's two or three different tracks here for parents to think about. There is the technical track, which is best approached through the technology lens, right? So you send your child, you know, at a high school level, you know, IT is not something I would suggest people worry about. They worry about maths, they worry about science, they worry about English, right? All the core disciplines. IT is something you can always learn later, but you've got the core, you got to get the core really strong. You might want to create that love of IT through programming, you know, things like code combat, et cetera, getting your kids to program robots or getting fascinated by the engineering of it. But really the core thing that allows you to get to university and learn the, you know, the right courses are around engineering and IT, right? And you have to, you want to get to the top university, you just have to score really well, right? That's the bottom line there. But so you've got the engineering through the university. And I've noticed in the last, again, 5 or 6 years, is that a lot of businesses are hiring for the lowest, they tend to hire IT people. First of all, organizations tend not to hire cybersecurity people from high school, right? They don't, you have to start off as IT, right?
Okay.
So they usually, what happens is people who want to get into cybersecurity are IT professionals with considerable IT experience, but don't have cybersecurity specific experience. So they basically cross skill, right? So they move laterally in their organization from what is a very technical IT role to a cybersecurity role. So it becomes like a specialization for them, mm-hmm. where their core skill is IT, but their specialization is cybersecurity.
Right.
So this is the trend at the moment. Mm-hmm. So, and unfortunately what happens is a lot of training, you know, education providers are pumping out high school, people who've gone from high school straight to university as cybersecurity specialists, but they're not being hired, mm-hmm. right? Because when they apply for a job, organizations are saying, wait, you've got no IT experience. I'm not going to take you in cybersecurity. First you need to get IT experience, then come to us, talk about cybersecurity, right? But that's what's happening in the technical, you know, area. In the non-technical area, things are very interesting. You're getting a lot of professionals who are coming not through the technology stack, but through the managerial stack or through other parts of the organization, and are moving into cyber because there's this broad now realization that cybersecurity is not a technical problem, but it's got psychology dimensions, it's got management dimensions, it's got, you know, a whole range of different dimensions. And I was having a conversation with one of the leads of AustCyber, which is the peak body, you know, in Australia. And she was saying that there are more jobs, more non-technical cybersecurity jobs than there are technical cybersecurity jobs at the moment.
Wow, that's very interesting. So
that was mind-blowing to me, yeah. And made me very happy, because all the people that I teach at the university are non-technical people. And I teach them to, you know, all the training that we give or education we give are to create consultants, you know, who eventually go into Deloitte, KPMG, Pricewaterhouse, or go into the big banks or the telecoms organizations, but they go in as managers, right? And senior analysts and managers rather than in the IT operations part. So they're not architects or forensics people or network engineers, but they're more sort of managerial people, you know, who are known for their non-technical capability.
So what does it take to get to that level, hypothetically?
So you mean managerial?
Exactly.
Manager. Well, there's two routes to the management. One is you go through the tech stack and then you realize that you can't go up any higher. So you become a manager, right? That's one possibility. The other possibility is you come in as a business analyst or as a project manager. And then you find yourself in coordination and management, but in the cybersecurity area where you don't necessarily have a technical background, but you understand enough about it to be able to manage it, right? So mm-hmm. those are two of the key pathways, but there are others.
Yeah. All right, speaking of pathways, what kind of pathway would you suggest for someone who wants a change later in life? Is this a field that someone can jump into in their 30s or 40s?
Absolutely. I in fact, would strongly suggest those people who have a fascination with cybersecurity and want to get into it need to think about cross-skilling, lateral movement into the cybersecurity area. And then the question is, well, how does somebody who is maybe in their mid-30s or mid-40s then start a second career in cybersecurity, right? Well, it's interesting actually to know that a lot of people move into new roles that are outside of their traditional, you know, training or education, simply because an opportunity exists within their organization, right? So one of the things that I say to people very often is, if you want to target a role, for example, if you are a mid-level manager in some business side of the organization, and you want to get into cybersecurity, you might want to think about an intermediary role. Right, you might want to think about, okay, I'm currently, you know, in an organization where there's no cybersecurity going on. Let me find an organization that takes cybersecurity really seriously and has roles that are similar to the ones that I want to do. Question number one is, how do I get into that organization? first. Not necessarily applying for that cybersecurity position, but just getting into the organization, maybe as a, you know, as the same role that I'm in now. If I'm a business analyst, I can go in as a business analyst into the other organization, and then I'll move laterally, right? So don't think about trying to make the jump immediately as your next job, but maybe think about making cybersecurity your second or third job after the one that you've got now or the one that you're going to apply for. And then think about how you're going to get the knowledge required to be able to get there. And one way to do that is micro-credentials, which is now, you know, really, you know, a lot of universities are offering micro-credentials. And universities are beginning to change as well. They're realizing that they can no longer be the university of the past. The university of the future is a completely different organization, which basically provides, you can say, training support to people in their post-professional life, right? So in the olden days, you would go to university after high school, spend 2 to 3 years or 4 years, and then you'd go into your working life, and that's it. You know, you would never come back to university. You know, your end of your education career, beginning of your working career, right? Goodbye, university. But now universities are thinking, hold on, you know, the person who started that career is not going to stay in that career. Maybe in the past, you could be in one career for 20 years, 30 years, but now people are changing their roles and their careers every 3 to 5 years. So what about that gap in knowledge that, you know, that needs to be filled from there every time they move from one role to another? The university has a place there. So how do we bring education to them inside of their work environment rather than to ask them to leave their work environment and come onto campus, right? So that's where micro-credentials come into the story, right? So micro-credentials are a very flexible form of learning where the post-professional can do it on their own time. It's very flexible. It can be asynchronous, as in they do it, you know, not in using live seminars or live teaching. And they can get the education they need and the knowledge that they need to be able to do the next role really well, right? So I would suggest that people look up cybersecurity micro-credentials and find out if that could help them to introduce, you know, their mind to what is cybersecurity and what kind of careers exist and what they want to do.
Are there any particular ones that you would recommend as a starting point?
Oh, there's heaps of them now, at RMIT and Swinburne. I mean, I've got my own. So, I designed 4 micro-credentials for professionals to do exactly this, you know, introduce them to cybersecurity and build the knowledge that they need to and so forth. Yeah, absolutely. There's heaps.
You seem very modest. You're not mentioning what the micro-credentials are, just so that you can plug your own stuff.
So, I mean, I created 4 of them. So the first one is cybersecurity in organizations, which basically gives people the analytical tool. You know, how do you take any cybersecurity problem and distill it to its key fundamental dimensions and develop enough confidence that you can deal with security or cybersecurity, right? And then it kind of builds the knowledge of the person. What's an asset? You know, how do you identify an asset? Who are the key threat actors? What kind of attacks do they level? What's risk management and how do you control the tactical environment? And then I introduce a whole range of different tools from intrusion detection, firewalls, to strategy, training, policy, all those different things.
Yeah.
And advanced topics as well, you know, threat intelligence and all those sorts of things. It's like a full, you know, all-encompassing unit for people who don't have a technical background and want to understand what cybersecurity is and also practice it.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. One of the things I've been hearing is that there's plenty of job prospects as well in relation to this field.
Yeah, so there's a national crisis at the moment in Australia around the cyber skills shortage, right? It's very well documented. The number of jobs out there and the number of, so the disconnect between demand and supply is huge. There's a huge demand and there's very little supply. Now, having said that, it doesn't necessarily mean that the supply that does exist is a supply that industry wants, right? There is a demand, a huge demand, but industry keeps saying they can't find the kinds of people they need, right? And the people that are being created on the supply side aren't fitting what the demand side wants. So yes, there are lots of jobs, but there are particular types of jobs. And if people want to get into that field, they need to be a little bit, you know, tactical about it go to the job seeker sites and download all the different job ads and try to come up with persona profiles of people that our industry is looking for. And then think about that. That's one key way. But then, as I said previously, the other key way is to target the organization first and find your way into it rather than trying to get through the front door, which is very hard because there's huge competition, you know, especially for Muslims. And I feel, I've always felt that Muslims are at a disadvantage, you know, in terms of job interview applications and so forth. And everybody, I think, on this, on your podcast will know exactly what I mean, right? So we as Muslims have this additional challenge that we have to work harder and distinguish ourselves more than the average person. And so one way to do that is to use your LinkedIn profile. That's another thing I would suggest to everybody is you need to have a LinkedIn profile. You need to develop your pro, you know, your external looking story. Who are you? What have you done? Why are you special? And your job, your next job will probably come through LinkedIn rather than through writing applications, you know, which you should do anyway. But, you know, yeah, there's, you have to be creative about getting a job if you're Muslim.
No worries. It sounds very optimistic in the sense that you're explaining it, but it also sounds as though there's quite a bit of legwork in relation to getting things rolling. Yeah,
absolutely.
So as we sort of taper off, inshallah, what final words would you like to offer the listeners? Well, are they open to contacting you outside of the podcast?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the best way to contact me is through LinkedIn, right? And you know, put in a request for a you know, LinkedIn connection, and in your request say who you are, and you know, mention this podcast, inshallah, and I will.
I hope I get royalties or something like that.
Inshallah, you get all the barakah for any of the value that's exchanged in that connection. You know,
good response.
Inshallah. So yeah, I mean, that's definitely connections are welcome. I'm always interested in meeting new brothers and sisters and assisting them in any way that I can. But in terms of advice, I think there's two things, you know, there's two things to cybersecurity. There's the whole professional thing about it. You know, I want a job in it. I want to get into this industry. But then there's the other side of it, which is I exist in the digital environment. I interact with others in the digital environment. So I have a responsibility to take control of my digital home and my digital ecosystem or footprint and become responsible about protecting myself and the people that I love in the digital environment by finding out more about it and being very careful about how I negotiate that environment and interact with digital assets, right? It's very critical. It's very important for people to understand what security and privacy means and how to protect themselves in the digital environment. And that's another topic for another podcast, really, because there's children there, there's parents there, there's, you know, there's oneself and there's the risk exposures, there's the digital home, there's the digital workplace and the digital, you can say transit, you know, when you're moving from home to wherever you're going. And they all are three different risk ecosystems, right? The workplace has its own ecosystem. You have your own ecosystem at home and you have the ecosystem you're moving, the multiple ecosystems you're moving through. You know, you go onto a tram, you go onto a bus, you walk, you, all of these are different risk environments that you go through. And you need to know how to negotiate those environments and you need to be able to protect yourself in all those environments. And that means you need to take control of the situation, right? That's important.
I really enjoyed this discussion that we've had so far. And the topic that you're referencing now is quite interesting as well. Can I get confirmation right now that you can do a second episode at some point in the future?
You're putting me on the spot.
I'm trying to lock it in right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would be very happy to talk about the other aspect, the other story, or the, you know, the other face of cybersecurity, which is the personal.
Yeah.
Personal cybersecurity.
I'm sure it's something which all my listeners will be interested on. So lastly, Luca, I thank you for your appearance on the Kalamcast podcast. And again, it'd be great to hear and see from you again. And I thank you for your participation. I know you're a busy person. And it means a great deal for me that you could make time for this discussion that we've had so far.
Jazakallah khair to yourself, and jazakallah khair to all the listeners for taking time to listen to this discussion. And the big plug for me, I really love Sheikh Furqan, and have had a wonderful experience on this podcast and on many other projects there where I've had the fortune to work with you. May Allah bless your podcast and bless all your endeavors, and make them for the benefit of yourself and for the ummah.
Ameen.
Ameen. Ameen. Salaam alaikum. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.